welcome everyone. Thanks for coming out on this crazy, freaky, cold night. Glad to see you all here. Our speaker tonight is Emily Bamforth. Emily's talking tonight because she loves dinos and she's loved them for a long time. Her favorite dinosaur was Parasaurolophus. That's Parasaurolophus. Let's get him on camera. Tonight she's going to talk about how dinos, well, how we misunderstand, how we just have sort of got a lot of myths out there about dinosaurs and what they are. Emily did her undergrad at the University of Alberta. She then did her master's at Queen's University, where she studied organisms way, way older than dinosaurs. She studied very early organisms from the Ediacaran formation. That's about 560 million years old.
65 million. Yeah.
65, sorry. Off by 5 million years. And she's been here since 2008. She's with the Larson Paleo Lab. She's studying the paleoecology of a group of dinos from southwestern Saskatchewan. The one she's been working on for the last 3 years is named Scotty. Scotty is a very, very old lady dinosaur. Associated with that site is a juvenile T-Rex called Ginny. I'm not sure if she's going to tell you about those tonight. That could be another Freaky Friday maybe, but Misunderstanding of Dinosaurs, Emily Bamforth.
Well, thank you so much for all coming out tonight. It's great to see so many people. I'm just going to preface this talk by saying that dinosaurs are awesome. And I feel the fact that dinosaurs are such a huge icon in popular culture is probably the best thing that's ever happened to paleontology, and I would argue science. Dinosaurs are so amazing and so huge and just so different that they really inspire people's imaginations. They get them to ask questions. They get them to want to learn more. And what is really great about dinosaurs is that it gets kids excited as well. So it's so wonderful to see so many kids out there today. Like Ingrid mentioned, I was very young when I first got into dinosaurs. I was actually 4 years old and saw my first dinosaur and fell in love. And I've never wanted to do anything else besides be a paleontologist from that moment. So dinosaurs have really inspired me and had a big impact on my life. But like anything that is very popular, there are a lot of myths and misconceptions surrounding dinosaurs. And so what I want to do today is to demystify some of those myths, not to shake the foundations of your dinosaurian knowledge, but because I believe that the truth is even more exciting. So today I want to tackle four basic myths surrounding dinosaurs. The first myth is that any large reptile living a long time ago was a dinosaur. So there's this idea that back in the dinosaur days, everything that walked on land and swam in the oceans and flew in the air was a dinosaur. That is a misconception. The second myth is that dinosaurs are monsters. Dinosaurs are not monsters. Dinosaurs are animals. So I'll explain a little bit about the way that we view them as animals and not monsters. The third myth, and this ties in very closely with the popular culture idea, is we could bring dinosaurs back if we found enough mosquitoes and amber. So this is the Jurassic Park scenario. So I'll go a little bit into that, just because it's a question I get asked a lot. And the fourth myth is that paleontology as a science is all about dinosaurs. Paleontologists actually study a lot more other than dinosaurs. So I'll talk very briefly about that because I think it's an important thing to realize is that paleontology is a very broad science. So before I go into these myths, what I would like to do is to explore a little bit about where these dinosaur myths come from. So I would say, without question, the biggest purveyor of dinosaur myths are movies and television. And it's not hard to understand why this is. Dinosaurs are really cool. And so they've been in movies pretty much as long as people have figured out how to make them look real in movies. So, for example, since the 60s, 1 million years BC from 1966, and the Valley of Gwangju from 1969, these were two of some of the first movies that actually had dinosaurs in them. And since that time, of course, there's been a whole slew of dinosaur movies. Jurassic Park is probably the most well-recognized ones, but there's also movies like Disney's Dinosaur as well. So pitched at adults, pitched at kids, pitched at all different audiences, dinosaurs have been in the movies for a long time. So there's basically two camps of dinosaurs in movies. The first one is where they are portrayed as monsters. So even as far back as 1 million years BC, we had dinosaurs in movies attacking people. And in Jurassic Park, they were attacking people again. Sometimes they attack non-human primates as well. And sometimes they just attack each other. So a lot of the time in movies, we have dinosaurs attacking things, other things. But there are other kinds of dinosaur movies, the ones that are pitched towards kids. Now, these movies also have misconceptions in them. So in my head, I was trying to imagine what it would be like if these dinosaurs took a break. Let's say they're on their break from filming the movie. What kind of discussions would they have? So you might have Littlefoot here saying, "Well, actually, I'm from the Jurassic. I fell into a Cretaceous time warp." I think the movie's set in the Cretaceous period. Littlefoot was actually from the Jurassic. Petrie, the dinosaur, or the flying dinosaur portrayed in the movie, is not actually a dinosaur, and I'll explain why that is. Have you ever noticed that Ducky, the dinosaur, has got eyelashes? Eyelashes are hair, and only mammals have hair. So Ducky, if she was a real dinosaur, would not have eyelashes. Similarly, Sarah is pointing out that she has external ears. Okay, reptiles don't have external ears. They're there so that she looks cuter, I guess. And have you ever noticed that the first time you see Spike, he's eating grass? Grass didn't evolve until about 30 million years after the dinosaurs went extinct. So there are a few misconceptions here as well. So besides movies, there are also other ways that dinosaurs get into popular culture. This is probably what I consider to be the longest-suffering prehistoric creature that has been called a dinosaur. This is Dimetrodon, so you probably recognize him. He turns up in all kinds of different venues. You can see here lots of toys have got Dimetrodons in it. If you're going to fight aliens, apparently Dimetrodons are good for that as well. You want a plasma dinosaur, you have a Dimetrodon there. And these up here, these are called dinosaurs. Has anyone ever tried them? Dinosaurs? So good. So good. But you'll notice that this one, and there's another one here, these are actually Dimetrodon as well. So in the dinosaurs, we've got Dimetrodon. So this is a problem, because not only was Dimetrodon not a dinosaur, not only did it go extinct long before the first dinosaurs evolved, but it's actually more closely related to you and me than it is to dinosaurs. And I'll explain why that is in a little bit. But some paleontologists have taken it upon themselves to get this word out here. This is from a website called Paleo Artists, and they make things like t-shirts and bags and water bottles that have this kind of logo on it that they really want to get out to the world that Dimetrodon was not a dinosaur. So this poor Dimetrodon now has a bit of an identity crisis going on. The other problem with dinosaurs in popular culture is that they're not static. So we all know that dinosaurs are extinct, but our ideas about them continue to evolve. So you remember the part in Jurassic Park where they're driving past the T-Rex paddock, and Lex turns around and asks, "What's going to happen to the goat?" And Grant from the other car, he's the paleontologist, says, "T-Rex doesn't want to be fed. It wants to hunt." But that was Jurassic Park 1. If you've seen Jurassic Park 3, the T-Rex is not hunting. It's scavenging. And the reason for that is because our ideas about what T-Rex was doing as a hunter, how it got its food, have changed. So here Grant is saying, "Well, T-Rex doesn't want to be fed. It wants to be hunt. It wants to hunt. No, wait. It wants to scavenge. No, wait. It wants to hunt as a juvenile and scavenge as an adult. No, wait. Let me go consult the latest T-Rex publication." So our ideas about dinosaurs are constantly changing. And sometimes, as the science changes, the popular culture is a little bit slow to keep up with that. Now, sometimes paleontologists themselves are guilty of giving dinosaurs this monstrous persona. You just have to look at the names of some of them to see that they are really they're really trying to get across that monstrous nature. So, for example, Tyrannosaurus rex means tyrant lizard king. Deinonychus, terrible claw. Dinocaris, terrible hand. Carnotaurus, flesh-eating bull. Truodon, wounding tooth. Dracovex hoguensia, this is a real dinosaur. Dragon king of Hogwarts. So that last one is actually what's called a pachycephalosaurus. It's the one with the big dome heads. And this particular one had a whole bunch of different spikes coming off the side of it. So the paleontologist who named it decided it was going to be called Dragon King of Hogwarts. So sometimes we are really guilty of giving dinosaurs monstrous names. But other times we're really not. So this is Bambi Raptor. And it is named for the reason you think. It's named after Bambi. And the reason is because it's very small. And so I guess if you get around the fact that it has razor-sharp teeth and a sickle-killing claw, it could be cute. I mean, it had feathers, so it might have been fluffy. So they decided to call it Bambi Raptor. So this is the reconstruction. This is the actual fossil. This is the reconstruction. But I have to admit that this was more like what first came to my mind when I heard the word Bambi Raptor. So sometimes we give dinosaurs monstrous names. Sometimes we give them not so monstrous names. But the naming thing is an issue sometimes. Okay, so on to the first myth. Myth number one, a dinosaur is any large reptile that lived a long time ago. So it's time for some audience participation. How many dinosaurs do you see in this slide? So what we have here, this is a Ryanosuchid, sort of a quadrupedal type thing that lived a long time ago. An Allosaurus. This is a pterosaur, or like a flying reptile, like a pterodactyl. An Ichthyosaur, this is a marine reptile, and a Plesiosaur. So I'll give you a second to count and decide how many dinosaurs there are there. Okay. So how many of you thinks there are no dinosaurs there? Okay. How many people think there are one? Two? Three? Four? We're at five. Six? That's okay. Just checking. So it looked like there was a pretty good spread of answers there, but I think most of the majority of people actually got it right. There is only one dinosaur in this picture. That is the Allosaurus. So there's a few different reasons why dinosaurs are dinosaurs and why things like pterodactyls, pterodons, marine reptiles are not. And also Dimetrodon, I should throw in there too. Commonly called a dinosaur, but is not. So one thing that makes a dinosaurs dinosaurs is that they lived in an era called the Mesozoic. So the weird thing about dinosaurs is they lived a long time ago, but relatively speaking, they didn't live that long ago. So this is a history of life on Earth. We can pretend this is the Archaean. Pretty much nothing lived here except for primordial slime. At the very end of this period, the yellow one, it's called the Proterozoic, we started to have the very first animals evolving. So in this green part, we had the very first animals. Then there was about 300 million years before the first dinosaurs evolved. Dinosaurs occupied this blue block here. You see, it's called the Mesozoic. Then they went extinct. And then there was 65 million years before we came on the scene. So there was a long time before the dinosaurs. There's also a considerably long time after the dinosaurs. So anything that lived before the Mesozoic is not a dinosaur. Anything that lived after the Mesozoic, besides the birds, we consider modern birds to be avian dinosaurs, but besides them, anything else is not a dinosaur. So just to go a little bit more into the Mesozoic, to sort of zoom in on that green slice that you saw there, in the Mesozoic era, there were three what we call periods. So we separate eras into smaller periods. So in the very first period, this is the earliest period that we find dinosaurs, they actually didn't appear until the late Triassic period, is what it's called. So the dinosaurs that we find here, the most common ones are what we call protosauropods. So this dinosaur here is called Plateosaurus. It looked like one of the long-necked dinosaurs, except it could stand up and walk on two legs, which the long-necked dinosaurs couldn't do. And we also have a variety of dinosaurs that are small and bipedal and ate meat. So the most common one that we find in the fossil record, at least, is this one called Coelophysis. If you go up to the gallery on the second floor, on the stairway, on the wall, we actually have a Coelophysis skeleton. So you can take a look at that. After the Triassic, dinosaurs were really starting to get into their element, into their swing. This was the period where we had things like Stegosauruses, Allosaurus, which was the top predator. Allosaurus looked like a Tyrannosaurus rex, except it was, well, superficially, it was actually much smaller. It had a different shape head. It had longer arms, and it had three fingers on its front feet. Instead of T-Rex, it had two, or Tyrannosaurus, which had two. The Jurassic was also the heyday of the sauropods, or the long-necked dinosaurs. And finally, in the Cretaceous period, this was the last period of the dinosaurs. This was when things started to get really exciting, when we started to see things that a lot of people recognize as dinosaurs. Things like horned dinosaurs, like Triceratops. These are the Ceratopsians. The Tyrannosaurids, these really, really big meat-eating dinosaurs. And things like the Dromaeosaurids. So these dinosaurs were the precursors of modern birds. So we can see that dinosaurs didn't all live in a huge hodgepodge together for 200 million years. They were actually separated by periods. And so they came and they went extinct. Another group would come and go extinct. Another group would come and go extinct. So we have a bunch of different groups that lived in a bunch of different times. Well, how, as paleontologists, do we organize these groups? I think, well, primarily it's important to understand that paleontology isn't part of biological science. So the way that we group dinosaurs together is the same way that biologists do. This is something that's called phylogeny. So it's a, don't be scared by the term. I'll try and explain how it works. So let's pretend that we have five animals. We have a shark, a frog, a lizard, a monkey, and a human. So what is the one thing that makes all that, the one thing that all of these animals share? Well, the fact that they're all animals. So we can draw a big circle around them and say, all of these are animals. Now, four of these animals have got lungs. So we can draw a circle around all the animals that have lungs. Similarly, we can draw a circle around all of the animals that can reproduce outside of water. So these are animals called amniotes because they have an amniotic egg. They don't have to go back to the water to reproduce. So we have two groups here, the monkey and the human, that have opposable thumbs and grasping hands. They can do this. And finally, we have the humans that have orthograde bipedalism, and this is something that only humans have. So this essentially is how we group organisms together. We group them together based on the shared characteristics. So this is a great way to do this, is to understand how groups are related to each other. However, in biology, we can't go drawing circles around each other because before very long, you're going to need a huge piece of paper. So what we do instead is we make a graph. Biologists are very fond of graphs. So we basically say, all right, these are our groups. We have the fish, the amphibian, the reptile, the monkey, and the human. And these are the characteristics or the traits. And if the group has got that trait, it gets a 1. If it doesn't, it gets a 0. So for example, the amphibian, the frog, is an animal, so it has a 1. It has lungs, so it has a 1. But it doesn't have an amniotic egg, so it gets a 0. Doesn't have grasping hands, gets a 0. It's not bipedal, so it gets a 0. So what we do with this is we take this and we feed it into a computer, and what we get out of it is a phylogenetic tree. So basically, what the phylogenetic tree tells us is when the traits that we're looking for evolved in relation to how soon the animals evolved. So for example, this trait here, we can say that at some point along this line, the characteristic of being an animal evolved. So after this point, everything that came after it was an animal. So if we have, so at some point after the shark split off, we had the evolution of lungs. So after this point, everything after that has got lungs. The same thing works for the amniotic egg. So the amniotic egg evolved after lungs evolved and after the frog split off. So everything after this has got lungs. Works the same way with the opposable thumbs. So opposable thumbs evolved before the monkeys and the humans split off. And finally, the bipedalism occurred in humans after we had separated from monkeys. So is that fairly intuitive for people?
Yeah.
All right, awesome. So phylogenies are really, really useful, both in biology and in paleontology, but especially for paleontologists. Because let's say we find a fossil and we don't know what it's related to. We can go back and we can plug in all of its traits into that matrix and figure out where it fits. So I'm just going to go over a fun example of how we do that with you. Okay. So let's look at mammals. So very briefly, this is Mammal Biology 101. So all mammals, the trait that unites the mammal group, they all produce milk to feed their young. We all have fur, and we're all endothermic, which means that we can regulate our own body temperature. So we know that mammals at some point were egg-laying. We have a mammal, we have a reptilian-like ancestor which laid eggs. And how do we know that for sure? Well, we know that because some mammals today actually still lay eggs. This is a group of mammals called the monotremes. So the monotremes, they're a very strange group. We find a few of them in the fossil record, but there's actually only two groups left today. One of them is the platypus. Does anyone know the other group? Spiny echidna, that's right. So if you don't know what an echidna looks like, as you go out of the auditorium today, just before you hit the main doors, look left in the curiosity cabinet. We actually have a stuffed echidna. So platypus and echidna, these are the only living monotremes, and they lay eggs. So this is a primitive trait. So at some point after the monotremes split off, mammals started to have live birth. They started to give birth to, or they stopped laying eggs and started to give live birth. This is also called viviparity. So mammals did that in two ways. Some mammals gave birth to a very immature baby, and that baby would crawl into a pouch, and it would develop outside the mother. So of course, these are the marsupials. So these are kangaroos, wallabies, wombats, all those animals that have pouches. So this pouch character is on the marsupial line because only marsupials have got it. And finally, the last group of mammals is like you and me, the placental mammals. We give birth to fully developed young, and so we don't have a pouch. We don't need one. So this includes things like bunnies and gym bunnies, or us. So let's say we're looking at this phylogeny, and we want to figure out where Easter bunnies fit. Anyone a fan of the Easter bunny out there? I am. Any scenario where I get chocolate is awesome. So we're going to figure out where Easter bunnies fit. So Easter bunnies, if you look at them initially, they look like normal bunnies, right? But they lay eggs. So we have two scenarios we can possibly work with here. The first one is that Easter bunnies were once normal bunnies, but they went back to laying eggs. Now, this is a possibility, but it goes against something that is called Dolo's Law. And Dolo's Law basically states that if you lose a complicated trait, it's very difficult to get it back again. So once they've lost the ability to lay eggs, they probably won't be able to get it back again, evolutionarily speaking. So that's probably not what happened here. What did happen here is maybe obvious because I've left a space for it, is that the Easter bunnies are actually monotremes. So they lay eggs because they're related to the platypus and the echidna. But maybe because they live in the same kind of habitats, they exploit the same food resources, they're exposed to the same kind of environmental stress, they've evolved to look like normal bunnies. So this, in evolution, this is what we call convergence. And it makes our job very interesting because we don't know if two things look the same because they're related or because they live in the same kind of environment. So this is a case of convergence. And so just for fun, because we have to have something that makes Easter bunnies different than normal bunnies. We have this trait here called the Cho egg gene. This is what turns the eggs into chocolate. So during the formation of the egg, it turns into chocolate because of this gene. So essentially, this is how phylogenies work. So going back to the dinosaurs, we had traits here like egg laying, live birth, having a pouch. So when we are working with what we call amniotic animals, that is animals that can reproduce out of water, the trait we use primarily to separate them is, oddly enough, the number of holes or fenestra that they have in the skull. So we basically have 3.5 groups here. So I'll explain why we have a half in a second. So we have what's called an anapsid condition, which is where this is the orbit or the eye hole. So there are no holes or openings behind that in the skull. So the holes are the opening. So the hole would have been called a post-orbital fenestra. So post-orbital, behind the eye, fenestra hole. Anapsids don't have one. So a modern example of an anapsid would be a turtle, because turtles have no holes in their skull other than their eye sockets. There's also synapsids. So synapsids have got one opening behind their eye, one post-orbital fenestra. These are things like mammals, like you and me. We are synapsids. And also like Dimetrodon, that sailback lizard I was talking about, is a synapsid, which is why it's more closely related to us than it is to dinosaurs. The third group is what's called a diapsid. So di meaning two. It has two holes behind the skull. This is the group that dinosaurs fit into. It's also the group that modern birds and modern lizards and lizard snakes also fit into. And so the half, we have 3.5. The half is what's called a eurapsid condition. And this is where there is also one hole in the skull, but it's not in the same place as the synapsid hole is. So we think what's happened here is that eurapsids were once diapsids, but that second hole here is actually closed up. So we think that these two groups are closely related to each other. And an example of a eurapsid would be some of the marine reptiles. So things like ichthyosauruses would be eurapsids. So those are really nice diagrams that look really great on paper. When you start picking up skulls and try to figure out where the holes are, it gets a little more complicated. But just to show you where these holes are in actual animals, so if you look at the Tyrannosaurus rex, this is the orbit here, and these are the two post-orbital fenestra behind that. If you were to look at a snake, this is the orbit, these are the two post-orbital fenestra. Again, these are diapsids, so they have two holes. In the synapsid condition, like we find in mammals, this is a deer, so this is the orbit, this is the post-orbital fenestra, again, it only has one. And you and me, we also have a post-orbital fenestra, but it's hard to find because our face is flat. But it's actually, if you were to look behind the eye, it's behind your cheekbone here. This is your post-orbital fenestra. So we are also synapsids. And just to give you an example of an anapsid, this is a turtle skull, and there are no holes in the skull other than the orbit. All right. So now we're clear on diapsids, anapsids, where dinosaurs fit, where mammals fit. Let's take a closer look at the dinosaur lineage. So here, what we have is an ancestor. So the ancestor of all of the groups that you see here was either a diapsid or a eurapsid. So again, this is, it either had two holes in the skull, or it once had two and it's lost one of them. So the diapsids are split into three basic groups. The first one is the archosaur morpha. So these are the groups that dinosaurs fit into, along with crocodiles, birds, and pterosaurs. So these are the archosaur morphs. We also have the lepiosaur morphs, which have the modern reptiles, modern snakes, and some of the marine reptiles. And we also have basal diapsids, which include the ichthyosauruses. So I just want to point out here that not only do marine reptiles, the plesiosaurs and the ichthyosaurs, not only do they not fit into the dinosaur group, but they don't actually fit into the same group. So they're what we call paraphyletic, which means that we throw them all into the same group just for the sake of simplicity, but they're actually not related to each other. So I want to look a little more at this group here, primarily because when I tell people that pterodactyls are not dinosaurs, they look at me like I've just told them that the world is about to end. So I just want to explain why this is. So again, we're looking at this group here, so the archaeosauromorphs, including the birds, crocodiles, pterosaurs, and dinosaurs. So if we were to take all of the dinosaur characters and all of the pterosaur characters, throw them all into a matrix and do a phylogeny, we get a phylogeny that looks a little bit like this. And what you can clearly see is that the pterosaur group is separated from the dinosaur group. Not only are they separated because they have different characters, but they're also separated because they diverged at different times. They split off from the common ancestor at different times. So the earliest pterosaurs occurred in the lower Triassic, whereas the earliest dinosaurs didn't evolve until the late Triassic. So this is the reason why pterosaurs are not dinosaurs. So just to leave this section with a general rule of thumb, basically all dinosaurs are diapsids. Dinosaurs are only found in the Mesozoic, and with the exception of birds, modern birds which fly, dinosaurs only lived on land. So back in the dinosaur days, if they flew in the air or they swam in the ocean, they're not dinosaurs. Okay. So on to myth number two. Dinosaurs are monsters. So I think that, well, one of the reasons that we have this myth again is because of things like TV and movies. I think the other reason that this idea prevails is because this is the context that we usually see dinosaurs in. They're usually in a museum, and we see them mounted, similar to the way that we see the Gorgosaurus mounted upstairs. But dinosaurs weren't living in an ecological vacuum or a biological void. They were actually part of a very complicated ecological and biological system. And we can see this not when we dig up dinosaur bones, we can put them together and make a dinosaur, but we can also tell so much more about that animal. So for example, if we look at things like bone beds. So these bone beds are large deposits of bone material found within a concentrated area. They may have accumulated over a long period of time. So for example, if we had a cut bank in a river, we could have bones deposited there over hundreds of years, but they could also be the result of a single catastrophic event. So if you go to Dinosaur Provincial Park, or if you go to Pipestone Creek in Alberta, we find these huge bone beds. And they're the result of a herd of dinosaurs that was crossing a river in flood, and essentially they all drowned. So we have the entire herd preserved. Well, a lot of them, most, the majority of the herd preserved as a bone bed. Bone beds are fantastic for dinosaur biology. They can tell us, they can identify the animal. So this particular dinosaur is called a Centrosaurus. It's kind of horned dinosaur. We can tell the number of animals. So in this case, what they can do is they can say, well, we know that every dinosaur only had one horn. So in order to get the minimum number of animals in the bone bed, we can count the number of nasal horns. We can also tell the age distribution of dinosaurs. Because we have the entire herd, we have adults, we have juveniles, we have babies, and we think that we can tell there's differences in the skeletons. So we can tell how many babies, how many juveniles, and how many adults there were. We can tell a little bit about interspecies relationships. A lot of the times when we see these huge bone beds that are associated with flood deposits, there's evidence of scavenging. So things like T-Rexes, or, well, it wouldn't have been T-Rex, it would have been Albertosaurus, Gorgosaurus, some of the small dromaeosaurs. There's a whole bunch of carcasses lying there, and they just went in and gorged themselves. And so we actually find their teeth embedded in some of the bones. We can tell a little bit about the social structure or the parenting, again, because we know the age distribution of the animals. We can make inferences about how, if they were taking care of their young, if it was one dinosaur taking care of lots of babies, if they only had one baby per dinosaur, those kind of things. And we can also tell a little bit about taphonomy. So that's what happened to the animals after they were dead and how they got into the fossil record. So this is something that can really help us to understand the fossilization process. Dinosaur trackways are another really good way that we can understand dinosaurs, again, as animals and not as monsters. We can tell, trackways can tell us the species that were present in an area. Sometimes we don't find fossils. All we find are trackways. And that's the only indication we have that those dinosaurs were there. We can tell how the animals moved. Were they walking on 2 feet? Were they working on 4 feet? Were they walking on 4 feet and running on 2 feet? Lots of dinosaurs do that a different way. We can tell how fast the animals moved by measuring the distance between the footprints and the distance between the stride lengths. We can tell if they were moving in a herd or whether they were moving individually. Again, we can tell interspecies interactions. There's trackways out there that actually have one dinosaur being chased by another dinosaur. We can see that in the footprints. And we can also tell species range. So were these dinosaurs staying in one place? Were they migrating? Were they seasonal residents and moved somewhere else in different seasons? So trackways can tell us all these different things. And these are things that animals in the world today do. Animals in the world today do, yeah. And what I think is really, really interesting is how dinosaur biology has allowed our ideas of what dinosaurs were to evolve. So my favorite example of this is the iguanodon. Iguanodon was discovered in 1834, and it was a complete skeleton. So in 1834, they had the whole dinosaur. And this was the reconstruction they had for the opening of the Crystal Palace in London. And so you can see it's basically like a huge lumbering lizard. They actually put the thumb on the nose. Even though it was on the hand, they thought they put it on the nose. So in 1960, we see that the idea has changed a little bit. Now we have the dinosaur on 2 legs, but you can still see it's dragging its tail a little bit. It still kind of looks like a lumbering lizard. And by 2003, we had a reconstruction that we understand today. So these dinosaurs were very fast, very agile, not slow or sluggish at all, but more like things like wildebeest and antelope and caribou that we see today. So again, it's really amazing to think that all three of these reconstructions were based on the same specimen, the same skeleton, and yet it's our ideas that have evolved. So I'd like to really briefly talk about something that I'm looking at, and this has to do with how dinosaurs are animals and not monsters. I'm working in the field of paleoecology. So again, paleontology is the study of ancient life through fossils. Ecology is the study of the interactions between organisms and their environment. And therefore, paleoecology is the study of the interactions between fossil organisms and their ancient environments. So this is a really interesting thing to try and get your head around. I'm working, as Ingrid mentioned, in southern Saskatchewan. And there's a very interesting connection between southern Saskatchewan and McGill University. This gentleman here was called George Mercer Dawson. He was a Canadian geologist, and he was in charge of mapping the 49th parallel, so the line between the United States and Canada. And in 1874, he was moving through this area of southern Saskatchewan, which is now Grasslands National Park, and he found and collected Canada's first dinosaur. So it probably looked like this. It was probably an Enanotitan, we think. Now, the interesting connection with McGill is that George Mercer Dawson was the son of William Dawson. William Dawson was the founder of the Redpath Museum. So that's a very interesting connection with the dinosaurs in southern Saskatchewan. So what I'm working with is not just dinosaurs, but I'm working with everything that has bones in Saskatchewan. So these are what are called vertebrate microfossils. So they include dinosaurs. These things here are our dinosaur teeth. We have some meat-eating dinosaurs, some plant-eating dinosaurs, but we also have things like birds, crocodiles, fish, turtles, frogs, amphibians, champsosaurs, which kind of look like crocodiles, but were a little bit different. And we also have mammals. So this is basically an entire vertebrate paleo community that is preserved. And what I'm looking at in my project is how the diversity of these vertebrates changed as we approached the extinction boundary. So this is just a few of my results to date. This is the dinosaur extinction boundary here at zero. And these bars are indicating how high or low the biodiversity was at that time. So this is ongoing work, but it's very interesting. And again, it's just another example of how dinosaurs were part of these very complicated biological systems. All right, myth number three. This is very brief. We could bring dinosaurs back if we found enough mosquitoes.
In amber.
That's very important. Yes. And let me just say, before I say anything, Jurassic Park is still my favorite movie. I love Jurassic Park. I think Michael Crichton was brilliant to come up with the idea. So Jurassic Park, really great science fiction, but it is fiction, sadly. Some of the reasons are it is that DNA is a biological molecule. Like any molecule, it breaks down over time, and after about 150,000 years, there is no information left in a DNA molecule. Secondly, even if you could get DNA out of a fossil mosquito, you would need a bazillion mosquitoes to do it. And there's a reason that amber is a semi-precious gem. It's because it's very rare. We don't even know if mosquitoes fed on dinosaur blood. Like, wouldn't it be such a downer if you went through all the work to get that drop of blood out of a mosquito and found out it was something like a frog or something? Again, even if you could extract that DNA, you would have no way of telling what was the mosquito DNA and what was the dinosaur DNA. You might end up with like a dino mosquito, which could be the sequel to tonight's movie. And finally, I can never really wrap my head around this. You know how they got the dinosaur sequence of DNA and they filled it in with frog DNA? Why wouldn't you use a reptile instead? Again, you would end up with a dino frog. There's all kinds of sequels to tonight movies you could go with. But if we were going to build a dinosaur, how would we do it? And the answer is, and this is something that is being looking at currently, not building a dinosaur, but sort of understanding how dinosaurs develop, is taking the DNA from a bird, specifically a chicken usually, and trying to figure out what makes a bird and a dinosaur different in terms of development, in terms of that developmental sequence. So this is something that was proposed by Jack Horner in his book, How to Build a Dinosaur. And of course, there's been all kinds of interesting illustrations that go with it. This is actually also work that's being partially done here at McGill in Hans Larsen's lab. We're not trying to make a dinosaur to hatch to reintroduce dinosaurs. What we were trying to do is to understand what makes a bird, and what would have made a dinosaur. So this was my lab's pumpkin. That we had a pumpkin carving competition. This is a chickenosaurus hatching from an egg. So we have lots of fun with that. So myth number four, and I'm just going to have enough time, I think. Paleontology is only about dinosaurs. Again, that's another misconception. So paleontology is the study of ancient life through fossils. So paleontology includes paleobiology, paleoecology, paleoclimatology, paleobotany, palynology, which is the study of fossil dust, paleolimnology, evolutionary biology, developmental biology, biostratigraphy, oil exploration. The field of paleontology is really immense, and there is a whole lot of application for training in paleontology, essentially. And again, I'll show this slide once again, just to illustrate that there is a whole lot of time in the history of life that is not dinosaurs. So, and interestingly, a lot of the interesting things that have happened in life happened a long time before the dinosaurs. So in Canada, Canada's an awesome place to be if you want to study paleontology, because we have some amazing fossil localities. We have things like the Gunflint Cherts, which preserve some of the very first microbial life. We have things like Mistaken Point in Newfoundland, which have some of the first multicellular life anywhere on the planet, the oldest fossils. We have the Burgess Shale, which has the very first animals. These are in British Columbia. We have Miguasha here in Quebec. This is the first time that fish came out onto land and became amphibians. We have Joggins in Nova Scotia. These are the first amniotes, the first time animals were able to reproduce outside of water. We have Dinosaur Provincial Park in Alberta, some of the best Cretaceous dinosaur assemblages found anywhere in the world. And actually, Currently four of these are UNESCO World Heritage Sites exclusively because of the fossils they contain. Mistaken Point here is a candidate World Heritage Site. And I'll just put in a little plug here. This is where I did my master's thesis research. And it is just the most incredible fossil locality I think I've ever seen. So it's on the tip of the Avalon Peninsula here. This is what the surface looks like. So these are the fossils here. You can see they're just impressions on the ground. This fossil surface is about the size of a basketball court. It is absolutely full of these fossils. These fossils are not plants, not animals, not bacteria, not fungi. They're a group of organisms that went completely extinct. And the interesting thing is that this pink stuff that you see here is mudstone. The gray stuff is volcanic ash. So what happened was that this paleo community was living on the sea floor, and it was covered by volcanic ash. And so this has been called the Ediacaran Pompeii. You can walk on the surface, and you're walking on an in-situ paleo community that's 500 million years old. And it really is, if you sit down and think about it, it's just the most incredible thing. So Canada has got some really amazing fossil localities. We do have amazing dinosaurs, but there's also a lot of other stuff out there too. And finally, I'd like to finish with one final myth. The myth is that we already know everything there is to know about dinosaurs. We've already found everything there is to be found. And this is probably the biggest myth, because we haven't found everything that is found. We haven't found nearly everything that is found. And it really is such a thrill to go out into the field and to find something like this and to know that it could be a new species. And even if it's not, you're probably the first person who has seen this bone in 65 million years. So it really is about the thrill of discovery. And the love of dinosaurs. So thank you very much. Are there any questions?
That dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago. When you corrected the lady at the very beginning, though, she said
60
billion, and you said 65.
So they went extinct 65 million years ago. And we know this from a variety of different proxies. So we can date the rocks, which is how we know that they're 65 million years old. We can also use things like paleomagnetism. So this is the switch, sometimes the poles switch from the North Pole is sometimes in the south, sometimes in the north. This is recorded in the signet in the rock record. And so by correlating those with the isotope dates, we can actually get a pretty good understanding of how old things are. Yeah?
Some of these things were used, and I can understand how they went extinct, but was there something about the environment back then that allowed huge things like that to grow? How come there aren't huge things like that now?
That's a really good question, and it's actually something that paleontologists have been struggling with for a long time. The American Museum of Natural History in New York just had an exhibit on the sauropods, the long-necked dinosaurs, the largest land animals ever to walk on Earth. And they're trying to figure out how they could possibly be that big and live at the same time. So it turns out they have a lot of skeletal modifications. They have things like hollow bones. They had a special breathing system. But in terms of why we don't find anything that big now, it's partially in that we've just passed a time where things were really big. So in the Ice Age, we had some very large mammals, and they've now gone extinct, and so everything is relatively small now. And we seem to go in these cycles of having big things and small things, and big things and small things. And no one is really sure why we seem to find those cycles of giganticism and getting smaller again. But good question. Yep.
For stuff like coloration of a dinosaur, like how do you get a sense of like what the like exterior of the dinosaur looks like apart from just the sort of shape?
That's a really good question. So we do have dinosaur skin preserved, so we know what the texture looked like in a lot of cases. In two cases, we actually have pigment preserved. These are in feathered dinosaurs. And so in the feathers, we actually have pigment preserved. I believe it's Anchiornis and Microraptor, I want to say. So one of them was red, and one of them was black and white like a magpie. So those are actually the only two dinosaurs we have actual color for. The rest is conjecture based on modern reptiles and modern birds. So if you see a dinosaur that is like bright pink with orange stripes, that's an artistic, an artistic thing.
Excuse me?
Yes.
How do you know if the dinosaur had feathers or not?
Good question. We actually find feathers preserved in the rocks.
Oh, yeah.
So if you were to go upstairs and look at the Archaeopteryx we have there, you can actually see the feathers. They've been pressed into the mud, and the mud has turned into a rock, and they've been the impressions have been fossilized. Good question. Yeah.
When the comet struck the planet, and we attribute the extinction of dinosaurs to that, I believe that the extinction had probably already begun, and just added to it. Do we know? Because I've heard different things. Like, do we know if it hit the planet square, or that if it deflected?
It actually hit based on the shape of the comet and on the where we find the projecta. It probably hit at an acute angle. So it hit, and all of the, I can't think of the word now, but all this, yeah, it didn't actually deflect. It actually smashed into the planet and evaporated. So that's why we don't find the comet, is because the comet disappeared as soon as it hit the planet.
I just wondered possibly if it had been directed, that the result would have been worse for the planet.
If it had been head-on as opposed to oblique.
We'll never know.
The thing is that if it had been hit head-on, it could have affected the orbit or the tilt of the Earth, and so that obviously would have affected life considerably. Yeah?
Do we know anything distinctive about the dinosaur ecology in Canada?
In terms of?
Other places in the world. You talked about paleontology.
Yeah.
That term. So how many different zones are there in this Canada particular ecological zone at the time of the dinosaurs?
There's actually, there's been a work on a PhD student who just graduated who is looking at what's called beta diversity. So this is difference in diversity in two areas. So he was looking at Canada versus the southern states. And it actually doesn't look like there is much difference. And so one of the reasons why that might be is because the dinosaurs were migrating. So, I mean, again, like you mentioned, these are really big animals. And so it's not likely that they were staying in one place and that they could migrate over long distances. That said, I mean, there is a little bit of opposition to that. Like, different people have found different things in different places. So the jury is still out on that one. But in terms of my work, what I'm finding in southern Saskatchewan is quite similar to what's being found in, say, Montana and the Dakotas. It seems to be the same sort of environment, same sort of area. Yep?
This might be a silly question, but with the chicken example, would it be possible to figure out like what makes a chicken a chicken, and then just maybe like, kind of tamper with those and reverse them and make sort of a dinosaur?
Yeah, and we know that can be done to some extent. We even know in nature, there are sometimes chickens that are born with teeth. It's called an atavism or an evolutionary throwback. So we know that that genetic mechanism is still there. We just need to know how to turn it on and off. The other thing that we're sort of trying to do is to grow a tail on a bird. So, you know, birds today don't have tails, like don't have bony tails. So, you know, things like peacocks have feathers, but there's no modern birds that actually has a long tail like a dinosaur. So that's one of the other things that we could potentially we potentially change the genetic development so it would grow a tail. But again, the chances of these, we would never actually get a dinosaur, a chicken, to evolve into a dinosaur. We just don't have the knowledge of how genes work.
But do you think it would be maybe feasible?
You know, I don't think so. I think some of the genes that made a dinosaur are gone. And we have no idea what they would have been. It might be a good thing, though. I mean, I wouldn't really want T-Rexes running around today. I've seen Jurassic Park. Yep.
We would like to know if there was any chance that there was any overlap with dinosaurs and mammals. like the big mammals, the saber-toothed tigers, the woolly mammoths? Is there any overlap?
I'm sorry, I caught my throat. That's a good question. Mammals actually evolved before dinosaurs. It's another thing a lot of people don't realize, but they were very small. So the whole Mesozoic era, mammals were very small, and they were probably nocturnal. And it wasn't until dinosaurs died out that we think those niches opened up, or that more food resources became available, and that's when mammals began to get large. But we don't, in terms of the Ice Age, what we call the Ice Age mammals, never overlap with the dinosaurs.
Okay, so dinosaurs are exothermic. Is that right? Or another?
A lot of dinosaurs were what were called gigantothermic. So that what that basically means is that you're so big, it doesn't matter if you regulate your own temperature or whether you depend on the environment. You generate so much energy just being, just living, that you generate your own heat. So a lot of the big dinosaurs were gigantothermic. The smaller dinosaurs, the theropods, the one with feathers, we think may have been endothermic. So they may have been warm-blooded. And that feathers actually evolved for insulation. That's one of the theories. But there is a lot of evidence that someone like the mid-sized dinosaurs were maybe ectothermic. So it's a whole range.
For the gigantothermic ones, what was their living situation generally based on that? Because, with reptiles, you think of they have to, follow the sun and then, hide underground or something. But what, was there a type of living situation that they tended to follow?
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, the person to ask about that would be a sauropod expert. Their biggest problem would have been keeping cool, for sure. If you're the size of a sauropod and you live in a hot place, your surface area to volume ratio is just, off the scale. So they were obviously doing something to keep cool. But, I'm not sure if there's anything behavioral they could have done. Some dinosaurs had, the Spinosaurus had a fan that may have been used for thermoregulation, things like that.
Is there any way you can compare the biggest ones with, say, an elephant and their speed in running?
That's a good question. We think, based on a sauropod's size, that it actually couldn't run. So I don't know how many of you have seen King Kong. There's the part with, the sauropod stampede. The first time I saw that, I laughed, because there's nothing that big. There's no way something that big could run. It was just impossible mechanically. But some of the smaller ones...
size of an elephant.
Okay.
How fast do you think that could?
It's the way that we determine speed in dinosaurs is from trackways, and sometimes we can look at the muscle scars and the bone attachments to see how big the muscles would have been, and sort of compare it, scale it up from modern birds usually. But in terms of comparing it to a mammal is a little bit complicated, because dinosaurs and mammals generally had different body compositions. For example, the theropods had hollow bones, whereas elephants have solid bones. So it's differences like that makes it a little bit complicated sometimes. But in terms of dinosaur speed, they often look at things like ostriches and emus in terms of a modern analog.
Why do you like the Parasaurolophus so much?
I love that question. The reason is because in the Tyrrell Museum when I was growing up, they had this apparatus that it was basically the crest. It was the size of an actual Parasaurolophus crest, and you could blow into it and you could make the sound of a Parasaurolophus. And I just love that. So that's why it's my favorite dinosaur. Yeah?
I always get the impression that if it's cold in Canada, that dinosaurs aren't going to survive. And if it's the way you're talking about all of the dinosaurs and migrating and being too big or too small or nocturnal, how much does climate really, was it the same back then, or did climate play a big factor?
It was actually in the late Cretaceous period, where I'm working, And actually, for most of the Mesozoic, the world was much, much warmer. So at the late Cretaceous period, the Earth was so warm there was no polar ice caps, and there was tropical forests all the way up to the poles. And so we're looking at a very different environment. The interesting thing is, though, that Alberta and Saskatchewan back in the Cretaceous were in the same place they are now. Like, they haven't moved long, like the continents haven't moved that much. So the photo period would have been the same. So it would have been dark in the winter and warm in the summer. So the plants would have been affected by that, but not by the temperature so much. Yep.
What was that word you used to describe the chicken that had two fat teeth?
An atavism.
Earlier you were saying, we were talking about the Easter Bunny, the egg again, you said something called Dolo's Law.
Yeah.
And saying that re-evolving a complex trait seems to be so, like, so big and unlikely that you might as well just put it back there the other way. But doesn't the atavism?
Yeah, so the Dolo's Law would apply to a much longer evolutionary timescale. So relatively speaking, dinosaurs and birds are not that far separated yet. If they were separated by, say, 200 million years instead of 65 million, then Dolo's Law would probably apply a little bit more. But that is a good point, though.
I think we're going to wrap up the question period, because you've not only smashed a lot of myths and clarified a lot, but you've given us a lot of information. And you're going to sign off on this consent and release form so that this entire presentation, your slides and your talk and everything, will be available online. You guys can access it probably in about 10 days' time when they clean it up. So you'll be able to relive it again. You can also contact Emily. She works here. She has an office here. By email, you can get a hold of her. Thanks a lot for all your interest in dinos. Thanks, Emily. Hope to see you back here in about a month. Near Valentine's Day, a psychologist who specializes in oxytocin, which is the love hormone. She's going to tell us all about that. We're going to take a little break, 15 minutes.